"Are you a Christian?" said the humble Romanus. "It is your duty to abstain from the blood of your fellow Christians. Has the thirst of riches seduced you from the blessings of peace? Sheathe your sword, open your hand, and I will satiate the utmost measure of your desires." The reconciliation was sealed by domestic alliance. The freedom of trade was granted or restored. The first honors of the court were secured to the friends of Bulgaria above the ambassadors of enemies or strangers, and her princes were dignified with the high and invidious title of Basileus, or Emperor. But this friendship was soon disturbed. After the death of Simeon, the nations were again in arms. His feeble successors were divided and extinguished, and in the beginning of the 11th century, the second Basil, who was born in the purple, deserved the appellation of conqueror of the Bulgarians. His avarice was in some measure gratified by a treasure of 400,000 pounds sterling, 10,000 pounds weight of gold, which he found in the palace of Lychnidus. His cruelty inflicted a cool and exquisite vengeance on 15,000 captives who had been guilty of the defense of their country. They were deprived of sight, but to one of each 100, a single eye was left that he might conduct his blind century to the presence of their king. Their king is said to have expired of grief and horror. The nation was awed by this terrible example. The Bulgarians were swept away from their settlements and circumscribed within a narrow province. The surviving chiefs bequeathed to their children the advice of patience and the duty of revenge. When the black swarm of Hungarians first hung over Europe, above 900 years after the Christian era, they were mistaken by fear and superstition for the Gog and Magog of the Scriptures, the signs and forerunners of the end of the world. Since the introduction of letters, they have explored their own antiquities with a strong and laudable impulse of patriotic curiosity. Their rational criticism can no longer be amused with a vain pedigree of Attila and the Huns. But they complain that their primitive records have perished in the Tartar War, that the truth or fiction of their rustic songs is long since forgotten, and that the fragments of a rude chronicle must be painfully reconciled with the contemporary, though foreign, intelligence of the imperial geographer. Magyar is the national and oriental denomination of the Hungarians. But among the tribes of Scythia, they are distinguished by the Greeks under the proper and peculiar name of Turks, as the descendants of that mighty people who had conquered and reigned from China to the Volga. The Pannonian colony preserved a correspondence of trade and amity with the Eastern Turks on the confines of Persia, and after a separation of 350 years, the missionaries of the King of Hungary discovered and visited their ancient country near the banks of the Volga. They were hospitably entertained by people of pagans and savages who still bore the name of Hungarians, conversed in their native tongue, recollected a tradition of their long-lost brethren, and listened with amazement to the marvelous tale of their new kingdom and religion. The zeal of conversion was animated by the interest of consanguinity, and one of the greatest of their princes had formed the generous, though fruitless, design of replenishing the solitude of Pannonia by this domestic colony from the heart of Tartary. From this primitive country, they were driven to the west by the tide of war and emigration, by the weight of the more distant tribes, who at the same time were fugitives and conquerors. Reason or fortune directed their course towards the frontiers of the Roman Empire. They halted in the usual stations along the banks of the great rivers, and in the territories of Moscow, Kiev, and Moldavia, some vestiges have been discovered of their temporary residence. In this long and various peregrination, they could not always escape the dominion of the stronger, and the purity of their blood was improved or sullied by the mixture of a foreign race. From a motive of compulsion or choice, several tribes of the Khazars were associated to the standard of their ancient vassals, introduced the use of a second language, and obtained by their superior renown the most honorable place in the front of battle. The military force of the Turks and their allies marched in 7 equal and artificial divisions. Each division was formed of 30,857 warriors, and the proportion of women, children, and servants supposes and requires at least 1 million of immigrants. Their public councils were directed by 7 voivodes, or hereditary chiefs, but the experience of discord and weakness recommended the more simple and vigorous administration of a single person. The scepter, which had been declined by the modest Libidius, was granted to the birth or merit of Almus and his son Arpad, and the authority of the supreme Khan of the Khazars confirmed the engagement of the prince and people, of the people to obey his commands, of the prince to consult their happiness and glory. With this narrative, we might be reasonably content if the penetration of modern learning had not opened a new and larger prospect of the antiquities of nations. The Hungarian language stands alone, and, as it were, insulated among these Slavonian dialects, but it bears a close and clear affinity to the idioms of the Fennec race, of an obsolete and savage race which formerly occupied the northern regions of Asia and Europe. The genuine appellation of Ugri, or Igors, is found on the western confines of China. Their migration to the banks of the Irtysh is attested by Tatar evidence. A similar name and language are detected in the southern parts of Siberia, and the remains of the Fennec tribes are widely, though thinly, scattered from the sources of the Obi to the shores of Lapland. The consanguinity of the Hungarians and Laplanders would display the powerful energy of climate on the children of a common parent. The lively contrast between the bold adventurers who are intoxicated with the wines of the Danube and the wretched fugitives who are immersed beneath the snows of the polar circle. Arms and freedom have ever been the ruling, though too often the unsuccessful, passion of the Hungarians, who are endowed by nature with a vigorous constitution of soul and body. Extreme cold has diminished the stature and congealed the faculties of the Laplanders, and the Arctic tribes, alone among the sons of men, are ignorant of war and unconscious of human blood. A happy ignorance, if reason and virtue were the guardians of their peace. It is the observation of the imperial author of The Tactics that all the Scythian hordes resembled each other in their pastoral and military life, that they all practiced the same means of subsistence and employed the same instruments of destruction. But he adds that the two nations of Bulgarians and Hungarians were superior to their brethren, and similar to each other in the improvements, however rude, of their discipline and government. Their visible likeness determines Leo to confound his friends and enemies in one common description, and the picture may be heightened by some strokes from their contemporaries of the 10th century. Except the merit and fame of military prowess, all that is valued by mankind appear vile and contemptible to these barbarians, whose native fierceness was stimulated by the consciousness of numbers and freedom. The tents of the Hungarians were of leather, their garments of fur. They shaved their hair and scarified their faces. In speech they were slow, in action prompt, in treaty perfidious, and they shared the common reproach of barbarians, too ignorant to conceive the importance of truth, too proud to deny or palliate the breach of their most solemn engagements. Their simplicity has been praised, yet they abstained only from the luxury they had never known. Whatever they saw, they coveted. Their desires were insatiate, and their sole industry was the hand of violence and rapine. By the definition of a pastoral nation, I have recalled a long description of the economy, the warfare, and the government that prevail in that state of society. I may add that to fishing, as well as to the chase, the Hungarians were indebted for a part of their subsistence, and since they seldom cultivated the ground, they must, at least in their new settlements, have sometimes practiced a slight and unskillful husbandry. In their emigrations, perhaps in their expeditions, the host was accompanied by thousands of sheep and oxen, which increased the cloud of formidable dust and afforded a constant and wholesale supply of milk and animal food. A plentiful command of forage was the first care of the general, and if the flocks and herds were secure of their pastures, the hardy warrior was alike insensible of danger and fatigue. The confusion of men and cattle that overspread the country exposed their camp to a nocturnal surprise. Had not a still wider circuit been occupied by their light cavalry, perpetually in motion to discover and delay the approach of the enemy. After some experience of the Roman tactics, they adopted the use of the sword and spear, the helmet of the soldier, and the iron breastplate of his steed. But their native and deadly weapon was the Tartar bow. From the earliest infancy their children and servants were exercised in the double science of archery and horsemanship. Their arm was strong, their aim was sure, and in the most rapid career they were taught to throw themselves backwards and to shoot a volley of arrows into the air. In open combat, in secret ambush, in flight or pursuit, they were equally formidable. An appearance of order was maintained in the foremost ranks, but their charge was driven forwards by the impatient pressure of succeeding crowds. They pursued headlong and rash, with loosened reins and horrific outcries. But if they fled with real or dissembled fear, the ardor of a pursuing foe was checked and chastised by the same habits of irregular speed and sudden evolution. In the abuse of victory, they astonished Europe, yet smarting from the wounds of the Saracen and the Dane. Mercy they rarely asked, and more rarely bestowed. Both sexes were accused as equally inaccessible to pity, and their appetite for raw flesh might countenance the popular tale that they drank the blood and feasted on the hearts of the slain. Yet the Hungarians were not devoid of those principles of justice and humanity which nature has implanted in every bosom. The license of public and private injuries was restrained by laws and punishments, and in the security of an open camp, theft is the most tempting and most dangerous offense. Among the barbarians there were many whose spontaneous virtue supplied their laws and corrected their manners, who performed the duties and sympathized with the affections of social life. After a long pilgrimage of flight or victory, the Turkish hordes approached the common limits of the French and Byzantine empires. Their first conquests and final settlements extended on either side of the Danube above Vienna, below Belgrade, and beyond the measure of the Roman province of Pannonia, or the modern kingdom of Hungary. That ample and fertile land was loosely occupied by the Moravians, a Sclavonian name and tribe which were driven by the invaders into the compass of a narrow province. Charlemagne had stretched a vague and nominal empire as far as the edge of Transylvania, but after the failure of his legitimate line, the dukes of Moravia forgot their obedience and tribute to the monarchs of Oriental France. The bastard Arnulf was provoked to invite the arms of the Turks. They rushed through the real or figurative wall which his indiscretion had thrown open, and the King of Germany has been justly reproached as a traitor to the civil and ecclesiastical society of the Christians. During the life of Arnulf, the Hungarians were checked by gratitude or fear, but in the infancy of his son Louis, they discovered and invaded Bavaria, and such was their Scythian speed that in a single day a circuit of 50 miles was stripped and consumed. In the Battle of Augsburg, the Christians maintained their advantage till the 7th hour of the day. They were deceived and vanquished by the flying stratagems of the Turkish cavalry. The conflagration spread over the provinces of Bavaria, Swabia, and Franconia, and the Hungarians promoted the reign of anarchy by forcing the stoutest barons to discipline their vassals and fortify their castles. The origin of walled towns is ascribed to this calamitous period. Nor could any distance be secured against an enemy who almost at the same instant laid in ashes the Helvetian monastery of St. Gall and the city of Bremen on the shores of the Northern Ocean. Above 30 years the Germanic Empire, or kingdom, was subject to the ignominy of tribute, and resistance was disarmed by the menace, the serious and effectual menace of dragging the women and children into captivity, and of slaughtering the males above the age of 10 years. I have neither power nor inclination to follow the Hungarians beyond the Rhine, but I must observe with surprise that the southern provinces of France were blasted by the tempest, and that Spain, behind her Pyrenees, was astonished at the approach of these formidable strangers. The vicinity of Italy had tempted their early inroads, but from their camp on the Brenta they beheld with some terror the apparent strength and populousness of the new discovered country. They requested leave to retire. Their request was proudly rejected by the Italian king, and the lives of 20,000 Christians paid the forfeit of his obstinacy and rashness. Among the cities of the West, the royal Pavia was conspicuous in fame and splendor, and the preeminence of Rome itself was only derived from the relics of the apostles. The Hungarians appeared. Pavia was in flames. 43 churches were consumed, and after the massacre of the people they spared about 200 wretches who had gathered some bushels of gold and silver, a vague exaggeration, from the smoking ruins of their country. In these annual excursions from the Alps to the neighbourhood of Rome and Capua, the churches that yet escaped resounded with a fearful litany. O save and deliver us from the arrows of the Hungarians! For the saints were deaf or inexorable, and the torrent rolled forwards, till it was stopped by the extreme land of Calabria. A composition was offered and accepted for the head of each Italian subject, and 10 bushels of silver were poured forth in the Turkish camp. But falsehood is the natural antagonist of violence, and the robbers were defrauded both in the numbers of the assessment and the standard of the metal. On the side of the east, the Hungarians were opposed in doubtful conflict with the equal arms of the Bulgarians, whose faith forbade an alliance with the pagans, and whose situation formed the barrier of the Byzantine Empire. The barrier was overturned. The Emperor of Constantinople beheld the waving banners of the Turks, and one of their boldest warriors presumed to strike a battle-axe into the Golden Gate. The arts and treasures of the Greeks diverted the assault, but the Hungarians might boast in their retreat that they had imposed a tribute on the spirit of Bulgaria and the majesty of the Caesars. The remote and rapid operations of the same campaign appear to magnify the power and numbers of the Turks, but their courage is most deserving of praise, since a light troop of 300 or 400 horse would often attempt and execute the most daring inroads to the gates of Thessalonica and Constantinople. At this disastrous era of the 9th and 10th centuries, Europe was afflicted by a triple scourge from the north, the east, and the south. The Norman, the Hungarian, and the Saracen sometimes trod the same ground of desolation. And these savage foes might have been compared by Homer to the 2 lions growling over the carcass of a mangled stag. The deliverance of Germany and Christendom was achieved by the Saxon princes Henry the Fowler and Otto the Great, who in two memorable battles forever broke the power of the Hungarians. The valiant Henry was roused from a bed of sickness by the invasion of his country, but his mind was vigorous and his prudence successful. "My companions," said he, on the morning of the combat, "maintain your ranks. Receive on your bucklers the first arrows of the pagans, and prevent their second discharge by the equal and rapid career of your lances." They obeyed and conquered, and the historical picture of the castle of Merseburg expressed the features, or at least the character, of Henry, who, in an age of ignorance, entrusted to the finer arts the perpetuity of his name. At the end of 20 years, the children of the Turks, who had fallen by his sword, invaded the empire of his son, and their force is defined in the lowest estimate at 100,000 horse. They were invited by domestic faction. The gates of Germany were treacherously unlocked, and they spread far beyond the Rhine and the Meuse into the heart of Flanders. But the vigor and prudence of Otto dispelled the conspiracy. The princes were made sensible that unless they were true to each other, their religion and country were irrecoverably lost, and the national powers were reviewed in the plains of Augsburg. They marched and fought in 8 legions, according to the division of provinces and tribes. The 1st, 2nd, and 3rd were composed of Bavarians, the 4th of Franconians, the 5th of Saxons, under the immediate command of the monarch. The 6th and 7th consisted of Swabians, and the 8th legion of 1,000 Bohemians closed the rear of the host. The resources of discipline and valor were fortified by the arts of superstition, which on this occasion may deserve the epithets of generous and salutary. The soldiers were purified with a fast. The camp was blessed with the relics of saints and martyrs, and the Christian hero girded on his side the sword of Constantine, grasped the invincible spear of Charlemagne, and waved the banner of Saint Maurice, the prefect of the Thebaid Legion. But his firmest confidence was placed in the holy lance, whose point was fashioned of the nails of the cross, and which his father had extorted from the king of Burgundy by the threats of war and the gift of a province. The Hungarians were expected in the front. They secretly passed the Lech, a river of Bavaria that falls into the Danube, turned the rear of the Christian army, plundered the baggage, and disordered the legion of Bohemia and Swabia. The battle was restored by the Franconians, whose duke, the valiant Conrad, was pierced with an arrow as he rested from his fatigues. The Saxons fought under the eyes of their king, and his victory surpassed in merit and importance the triumphs of the last 200 years. The loss of the Hungarians was still greater in the flight than in the action. They were encompassed by the rivers of Bavaria, and their past cruelties excluded them from the hope of mercy. 3 captive princes were hanged at Ratisbon, the multitude of prisoners were slain or mutilated, and the fugitives who presumed to appear in the face of their country were condemned to everlasting poverty and disgrace. Yet the spirit of the nation was humbled, and the most accessible passes of Hungary were fortified with a ditch and rampart. Adversity suggested the counsels of moderation and peace. The robbers of the West acquiesced in a sedentary life, and the next generation was taught by a discerning prince that far more might be gained by multiplying and exchanging the produce of a fruitful soil. The native race, the Turkish or Fennec blood, was mingled with new colonies of Scythian or Sclavonian origin. Many thousands of robust and industrious captives have been imported from all the countries of Europe. And after the marriage of Giza with a Bavarian princess, he bestowed honors and estates on the nobles of Germany. The son of Giza was invested with the regal title, and the house of Arpad reigned 300 years in the kingdom of Hungary. But the freeborn barbarians were not dazzled by the luster of the diadem, and the people asserted their indefeasible right of choosing, deposing, and punishing the hereditary servant of the state. The name of Russians was first divulged in the 9th century by an embassy of Theophilus, Emperor of the East, to the Emperor of the West, Louis, the son of Charlemagne. The Greeks were accompanied by the envoys of the great Duke, or Chagan, or Tsar, of the Russians. In their journey to Constantinople, they had traversed many hostile nations, and they hoped to escape the dangers of their return by requesting the French monarch to transport them by sea to their native country. A closer examination detected their origin. They were the brethren of the Swedes and Normans, whose name was already odious and formidable in France, and it might justly be apprehended that these Russian strangers were not the messengers of peace, but the emissaries of war. They were detained while the Greeks were dismissed, and Louis expected a more satisfactory account, that he might obey the laws of hospitality or prudence, according to the interest of both empires. This Scandinavian origin of the people, or at least the princes of Russia, may be confirmed and illustrated by the national annals and the general history of the North. The Normans, who had so long been concealed by a veil of impenetrable darkness, suddenly burst forth in the spirit of naval and military enterprise. The vast and, as it is said, the populous regions of Denmark, Sweden, and Norway were crowded with independent chieftains and desperate adventurers who sighed in the laziness of peace and smiled in the agonies of death. Piracy was the exercise, the trade, the glory, and the virtue of the Scandinavian youth. Impatient of a bleak climate and narrow limits, they started from the banquet, grasped their arms, sounded their horn, ascended their vessels, and explored every coast that promised either spoil or settlement. The Baltic was the first scene of their naval achievements. They visited the eastern shores, the silent residents of Finnic and Sclavonic tribes, and the primitive Russians of the Lake Ladoga paid a tribute, the skins of white squirrels to these strangers, whom they saluted with the title of Varangians or Corsairs. Their superiority in arms, discipline, and renown commanded the fear and reverence of the natives. In their wars against the more inland savages, the Varangians condescended to serve as friends and auxiliaries, and gradually, by choice or conquest, obtained the dominion of a people whom they were qualified to protect. Their tyranny was expelled, their valor was again recalled, till at length Rurik, a Scandinavian chief, became the father of a dynasty which reigned above 700 years. His brothers extended his influence. The example of service and usurpation was imitated by his companions in the southern provinces of Russia, and their establishments, by the usual methods of war and assassination, were cemented into the fabric of a powerful monarchy. As long as the descendants of Rurik were considered as aliens and conquerors, they ruled by the sword of the Varangians, distributed estates and subjects to their faithful captains, and supplied their numbers with fresh streams of adventurers from the Baltic coast. But when the Scandinavian chiefs had struck a deep and permanent root into the soil, they mingled with the Russians in blood, religion, and language. And the first Vladimir had the merit of delivering his country from these foreign mercenaries. They had seated him on the throne. His riches were insufficient to satisfy their demands, but they listened to his pleasing advice that they should seek not a more grateful, but a more wealthy master, that they should embark for Greece, where, instead of the skins of squirrels, silk and gold would be the recompense of their service. At the same time, the Russian prince admonished his Byzantine ally to disperse and employ, to recompense and restrain, these impetuous children of the North. Contemporary writers have recorded the introduction, name, and character of the Varangians. Each day they rose in confidence and esteem. The whole body was assembled at Constantinople to perform the duty of guards, and their strength was recruited by a numerous band of their countrymen from the island of Thule. On this occasion, the vague appellation of Thule is applied to England. and the new Varangians were a colony of English and Danes who fled from the yoke of the Norman conqueror. The habits of pilgrimage and piracy had approximated the countries of the earth. These exiles were entertained in the Byzantine court, and they preserved till the last age of the empire the inheritance of spotless loyalty and the use of the Danish or English tongue. With their broad and double-edged battle-axes on their shoulders, they attended the Greek emperor to the temple, the senate, and the hippodrome. He slept and feasted under their trusty guard, and the keys of the palace, the treasury, and the capital were held by the firm and faithful hands of the Varangians. In the 10th century, the geography of Scythia was extended far beyond the limits of ancient knowledge, and the monarchy of the Russians obtains a vast and conspicuous place in the map of Constantine. The sons of Rurik were masters of the spacious province of Volodymyr, or Moscow, and if they were confined on that side by the hordes of the East, their western frontier in those early days was enlarged to the Baltic Sea and the country of the Prussians. Their northern reign ascended above the 60th degree of latitude over the Hyperborean regions, which fancy had peopled with monsters or clouded with eternal darkness. To the south they followed the course of the Borysthenes and approached with that river the neighborhood of the Black Sea. The tribes that dwelt or wandered in this ample circuit were obedient to the same conqueror and insensibly blended into the same nation. The language of Russia is a dialect of the Sclavonian, but in the 10th century these two modes of speech were different from each other, and as the Sclavonian prevailed in the south, it may be presumed that the original Russians of the north, the primitive subjects of the Varangian chief, were a portion of the Fennec race. With the immigration, union, or dissolution of the wandering tribes, the loose and indefinite picture of the Scythian desert has continually shifted. But the most ancient map of Russia affords some places which still retain their name and position, and the two capitals, Novgorod and Kiev, are coeval with the first age of the monarchy. Novgorod had not yet deserved the epithet of great, nor the alliance of the Hanseatic League, which diffused the streams of opulence and the principles of freedom. Kiev could not yet boast of 300 churches, an innumerable people, and a degree of greatness and splendor which was compared with Constantinople by those who had never seen the residence of the Caesars. In their origin, the two cities were no more than camps or fairs, the most convenient stations in which the barbarians might assemble for the occasional business of war or trade. Yet even these assemblies announce some progress in the arts of society. A new breed of cattle was imported from these southern provinces, and the spirit of commercial enterprise pervaded the sea and land from the Baltic to the Black Sea, from the mouth of the Oder to the port of Constantinople. In the days of idolatry and barbarism, the Sclavonic city of Julin was frequented and enriched by the Normans, who had prudently secured a free mart of purchase and exchange. From this harbour, at the entrance of the Oder, the corsair, or merchant, sailed in 43 days to the eastern shores of the Baltic. The most distant nations were intermingled, and the holy groves of Courlant are said to have been decorated with Grecian and Spanish gold. Between the sea and Novgorod, an easy intercourse was discovered. In the summer, through a gulf, a lake, and a navigable river. In the winter season, over the hard and level surface of boundless snows. From the neighborhood of that city, the Russians descended the streams that fall into the Borysthenes. Their canoes, of a single tree, were laden with slaves of every age, furs of every species, the spoil of their beehives, and the hides of their cattle, and the whole produce of the north was collected and discharged into the magazines of Kiev. The month of June was the ordinary season of the departure of the fleet. The timber of the canoes was framed into the oars and benches of more solid and capacious boats, and they proceeded without obstacle down the Borysthenes as far as the 7 or 13 ridges of rocks which traversed the bed and precipitate the waters of the river. At the more shallow falls it was sufficient to lighten the vessels, but the deeper cataracts were impassable, and the mariners, who dragged their vessels and their slaves 6 miles over land, were exposed in this toilsome journey to the robbers of the desert. At the first island below the falls, the Russians celebrated the festival of their escape. At a second, near the mouth of the river, they repaired their shattered vessels for the longer and more perilous voyage of the Black Sea. If they steered along the coast, the Danube was accessible. With a fair wind, they could reach in 36 or 40 hours the opposite shores of Anatolia. Then Constantinople admitted the annual visit of the strangers of the north. They returned at the stated season with a rich cargo of corn, wine, and oil, the manufactures of Greece and the spices of India. Some of their countrymen resided in the capital and provinces, and the national treaties protected the persons, effects, and privileges of the Russian merchant. But the same communication which had been opened for the benefit was soon abused for the injury of mankind. In a period of 190 years, the Russians made 4 attempts to plunder the treasures of Constantinople. The event was various, but the motive, the means, and the object were the same in these naval expeditions. The Russian traders had seen the magnificence and tasted the luxury of the city of the Caesars. A marvelous tale and a scanty supply excited the desires of their savage countrymen. They envied the gifts of nature which their climate denied. They coveted the works of art which they were too lazy to imitate and too indigent to purchase. The Varangian princes unfurled the banners of piratical adventure, and their bravest soldiers were drawn from the nations that dwelt in the northern isles of the ocean. The image of their naval armaments was revived in the last century, in the fleets of the Cossacks, which issued from the Borysthenes to navigate the same seas for a similar purpose. The Greek appellation of monoxyla, or single canoes, might justly be applied to the bottom of their vessels. It was scooped out of the long stem of a beech or willow, but the slight and narrow foundation was raised and continued on either side with planks, till it attained the length of 60 and the height of about 12 feet. These boats were built without a deck, but with 2 rudders and a mast, to move with sails and oars, and to contain from 40 to 70 men with their arms and provisions of fresh water and salt fish. The first trial of the Russians was made with 200 boats, but when the national force was exerted, they might arm against Constantinople 1,000 or 1,200 vessels. Their fleet was not much inferior to the royal navy of Agamemnon, but it was magnified in the eyes of fear to 10 or 15 times the real proportion of its strength and numbers. Had the Greek emperors been endowed with foresight to discern and vigor to prevent, perhaps they might have sealed with a maritime force the mouth of the Borysthenes. Their indolence abandoned the coast of Anatolia to the calamities of a piratical war, which after an interval of 600 years again infested the Black Sea. But as long as the capital was respected, the sufferings of a distant province escaped the notice both of the prince and the historian. The storm which had swept along from the Phasis and Trebizond at length burst on the Bosphorus of Thrace, a strait of 15 miles in which the rude vessels of the Russians might have been stopped and destroyed by a more skilful adversary. In their first enterprise, under the princes of Kiev, they passed without opposition and occupied the port of Constantinople in the absence of the Emperor Michael, the son of Theophilus. Through a crowd of perils he landed at the palace stairs, and immediately repaired to a church of the Virgin Mary. By the advice of the patriarch, her garment, a precious relic, was drawn from the sanctuary and dipped in the sea, and a seasonable tempest, which determined the retreat of the Russians, was devoutly ascribed to the Mother of God. The silence of the Greeks may inspire some doubt of the truth, or at least of the importance of the second attempt by Oleg, the guardian of the sons of Rurik. A strong barrier of arms and fortifications defended the Bosphorus. They were eluded by the usual expedient of drawing the boats over the isthmus, and this simple operation is described in the National Chronicles as if the Russian fleet had sailed over dry land with a brisk and favorable gale. The leader of the third armament, Igor, the son of Rurik, had chosen a moment of weakness and decay when the naval powers of the empire were employed against the Saracens. But if courage be not wanting, the instruments of defense are seldom deficient. 15 broken and decayed galleys were boldly launched against the enemy, but instead of the single tube of Greek fire usually planted on the prow, the sides and stern of each vessel were abundantly supplied with that liquid combustible. The engineers were dexterous. The weather was propitious. Many thousand Russians, who chose rather to be drowned than burnt, leaped into the sea. And those who escaped to the Thracian shore were inhumanly slaughtered by the peasants and soldiers. Yet one-third of the canoes escaped into shallow water, and the next spring, Igor was again prepared to retrieve his disgrace and claim his revenge. After a long peace, Yaroslaus, the great-grandson of Igor, resumed the same project of a naval invasion. A fleet under the command of his son was repulsed at the entrance of the Bosphorus by the same artificial flames. But in the rashness of pursuit, the vanguard of the Greeks was encompassed by an irresistible multitude of boats and men. Their provision of fire was probably exhausted. Then 24 galleys were either taken, sunk, or destroyed. Yet the threats or calamities of a Russian war were more frequently diverted by treaty than by arms. In these naval hostilities, every disadvantage was on the side of the Greeks. Their savage enemy afforded no mercy. His poverty promised no spoil. His impenetrable retreat deprived the conqueror of the hopes of revenge. And the pride or weakness of empire indulged an opinion that no honor could be gained or lost in the intercourse with barbarians. At first their demands were high and inadmissible. 3 pounds of gold for each soldier or mariner of the fleet. The Russian youth adhered to the design of conquest and glory, but the counsels of moderation were recommended by the hoary sages. "Be content," they said, "with the liberal offers of Caesar. Is it not far better to obtain without a combat the possession of gold, silver, silks, and all the objects of our desires? Are we sure of victory? Can we conclude a treaty with the sea? We do not tread on the land. We float on the abyss of water, and a common death hangs over our heads." The memory of these Arctic fleets that seemed to descend from the polar circle left deep impression of terror on the imperial city. By the vulgar of every rank it was asserted and believed that an equestrian statue in the square of Taurus was secretly inscribed with a prophecy, how the Russians in the last days should become masters of Constantinople. In our own time, a Russian armament, instead of sailing from the Borysthenes, has circumnavigated the continent of Europe. Then the Turkish capital has been threatened by a squadron of strong and lofty ships of war, each of which, with its naval science and thundering artillery, could have sunk or scattered 100 canoes, such as those of their ancestors. Perhaps the present generation may yet behold the accomplishment of the prediction, of a rare prediction, of which the style is unambiguous and the date unquestionable. By land, the Russians were less formidable than by sea, and as they fought for the most part on foot, their irregular legions must often have been broken and overthrown by the cavalry of the Scythian hordes. Yet their growing towns, however slight and imperfect, presented a shelter to the subject and a barrier to the enemy. The monarchy of Kiev, till a fatal partition, assumed the dominion of the north, and the nations from the Volga to the Danube were subdued or repelled by the arms of Svatoslaus, the son of Igor, the son of Oleg, the son of Rurik. The vigor of his mind and body was fortified by the hardships of a military and savage life. Wrapped in a bearskin, Svatoslaus usually slept on the ground, his head reclining on a saddle. His diet was coarse and frugal, and like the heroes of Homer, his meat, it was often horse flesh, was broiled or roasted on the coals. The exercise of war gave stability and discipline to his army, and it may be presumed that no soldier was permitted to transcend the luxury of his chief. By an embassy from Nicephorus, the Greek emperor, he was moved to undertake the conquest of Bulgaria, and a gift of 1,500 pounds of gold was laid at his feet to defray the expense or reward the toils of the expedition. An army of 60,000 men was assembled and embarked. They sailed from the Borysthenes to the Danube. Their landing was effected on the Mysian shore, and after a sharp encounter, the swords of the Russians prevailed against the arrows of the Bulgarian horse. The vanquished king sunk into the grave. His children were made captive, and his dominions, as far as Mount Hemus, were subdued or ravaged by the northern invaders. But instead of relinquishing his prey and performing his engagements, the Varangian prince was more disposed to advance than to retire. And had his ambition been crowned with success, the seat of empire in that early period might have been transferred to a more temperate and fruitful climate. Svatoslaus enjoyed and acknowledged the advantages of his new position, in which he could unite, by exchange or rapine, the various productions of the earth. By an easy navigation he might draw from Russia the native commodities of furs, wax, and hydromed. Hungary supplied him with a breed of horses and the spoils of the West, and Greece abounded with gold, silver, and the foreign luxuries which his poverty had affected to disdain. The bands of Patsanakites, Khozars, and Turks repaired to the standard of victory, and the ambassador of Nicephorus betrayed his trust, assumed the purple, and promised to share with his new allies the treasures of the Eastern world. From the banks of the Danube, the Russian prince pursued his march as far as Adrianople. A formal summons to evacuate the Roman province was dismissed with contempt, and Svatoslaus fiercely replied that Constantinople might soon expect the presence of an enemy and a master. Nicephorus could no longer expel the mischief which he had introduced, but his throne and wife were inherited by John Zimisces, who in a diminutive body possessed the spirit and abilities of a hero. The first victory of his lieutenants deprived the Russians of their foreign allies, 20,000 of whom were either destroyed by the sword or provoked to revolt or tempted to desert. Thrace was delivered, but 70,000 barbarians were still in arms, and the legions that had been recalled from the new conquests of Syria prepared, with the return of the spring, to march under the banners of a warlike prince who declared himself the friend and avenger of the injured Bulgaria. The passes of Mount Hemus had been left unguarded. They were instantly occupied. The Roman vanguard was formed of the immortals, a proud imitation of the Persian style. The emperor led the main body of 10,500 foot, and the rest of his forces followed in slow and cautious array with the baggage and military engines. The first exploit of Zimisces was the reduction of Marcianopolis, or Peristhlaba, in 2 days. The trumpets sounded. The walls were scaled. 8,500 Russians were put to the sword, and the sons of the Bulgarian king were rescued from an ignominious prison and invested with a nominal diadem. After these repeated losses, Svatoslaus retired to the strong post of Drista on the banks of the Danube, and was pursued by an enemy who alternately employed the arms of celerity and delay. The Byzantine galleys ascended the river. The legions completed a line of circumvallation, and the Russian prince was encompassed, assaulted, and famished in the fortifications of the camp and city. Many deeds of valor were performed. Several desperate sallies were attempted. Nor was it till after a siege of 65 days that Swatoslaus yielded to his adverse fortune. The liberal terms which he obtained announced the prudence of the victor, who respected the valor and apprehended the despair of an unconquered mind. The great Duke of Russia bound himself by solemn imprecations to relinquish all hostile designs. A safe passage was opened for his return. The liberty of trade and navigation was restored. A measure of corn was distributed to each of his soldiers, and the allowance of 22,000 measures attests the loss and the remnant of the barbarians. After a painful voyage, they again reached the mouth of the Borysthenes, but their provisions were exhausted. The season was unfavorable. They passed the winter on the ice, and before they could prosecute their march, Swatoslaus was surprised and oppressed by the neighboring tribes with whom the Greeks entertained a perpetual and useful correspondence. Far different was the return of Zimisces, who was received in his capital like Camillus or Marius, the saviors of ancient Rome. But the merit of the victory was attributed by the pious emperor to the Mother of God, and the image of the Virgin Mary with the divine infant in her arms was placed on a triumphal car, adorned with the spoils of war and the ensigns of Bulgarian royalty. Zimisces made his public entry on horseback, the diadem on his head, a crown of laurel in his hand, and Constantinople was astonished to applaud the martial virtues of her sovereign. Photius of Constantinople, a patriarch whose ambition was equal to his curiosity, congratulates himself and the Greek Church on the conversion of the Russians. Those fierce and bloody barbarians had been persuaded by the voice of reason and religion to acknowledge Jesus for their God, the Christian missionaries for their teachers, and the Romans for their friends and brethren. His triumph was transient and premature. In the various fortune of their piratical adventures, some Russian chiefs might allow themselves to be sprinkled with the waters of baptism, and a Greek bishop with the name of Metropolitan might administer the sacraments in the Church of Kiev to a congregation of slaves and natives. But the seed of the gospel was sown on a barren soil. Many were the apostates, the converts were few, and the baptism of Olga may be fixed as the era of Russian Christianity. A female, perhaps of the basest origin, who could revenge the death and assume the scepter of her husband, Igor, must have been endowed with those active virtues which command the fear and obedience of barbarians. In a moment of foreign and domestic peace, she sailed from Kiev to Constantinople, and the Emperor Constantine Porphyrogenitus has described with minute diligence the ceremonial of her reception in his capital and palace. The steps, the titles, the salutations, the banquet, the presents were exquisitely adjusted to gratify the vanity of the stranger, with due reverence to the superior majesty of the purple. In the sacrament of baptism, she received the venerable name of the Empress Helena, and her conversion might be preceded or followed by her uncle, 2 interpreters, 16 damsels of a higher and 18 of a lower rank, 22 domestics or ministers, and 44 Russian merchants who composed the retinue of the great Princess Olga. After her return to Kiev and Novgorod, she firmly persisted in her new religion, but her labors in the propagation of the gospel were not crowned with success, and both her family and nation adhered with obstinacy or indifference to the gods of their fathers. Her son Swatoslaus was apprehensive of the scorn and ridicule of his companions, and her grandson Volodymyr devoted his youthful zeal to multiply and decorate the monuments of ancient worship. The savage deities of the north were still propitiated with human sacrifices. In the choice of the victim, a citizen was preferred to a stranger, a Christian to an idolater, and the father who defended his son from the sacerdotal knife was involved in the same doom by the rage of a fanatic tumult. Yet the lessons and example of the pious Olga had made a deep, though secret, impression in the minds of the prince and people. The Greek missionaries continued to preach, to dispute, and to baptize, and the ambassadors or merchants of Russia compare the idolatry of the woods with the elegant superstition of Constantinople. They had gazed with admiration on the dome of Santa Sophia, the lively pictures of saints and martyrs, the riches of the altar, the number and vestments of the priests, the pomp and order of the ceremonies. They were edified by the alternate succession of devout silence and harmonious song. Nor was it difficult to persuade them that a choir of angels descended each day from heaven to join in the devotion of the Christians. But the conversion of Volodymyr was determined or hastened by his desire of a Roman bride. At the same time, and in the city of Kherson, the rites of baptism and marriage were celebrated by the Christian pontiff. The city he restored to the Emperor Basil, the brother of his spouse. But the brazen gates were transported, as it is said, to Novgorod, and erected before the first church as a trophy of his victory and faith. At his despotic command, Parund, the god of thunder, whom he had so long adored, was dragged through the streets of Kiev, and 12 sturdy barbarians battered with clubs the misshapen image which was indignantly cast into the waters of the Borysthenes. The edict of Volodymyr had proclaimed that all who should refuse the rites of baptism would be treated as the enemies of God and their prince. And the rivers were instantly filled with many thousands of obedient Russians, who acquiesced in the truth and excellence of a doctrine which had been embraced by the great duke and his boyars. In the next generation, the relics of paganism were finally extirpated. But as the two brothers of Volodymyr had died without baptism, their bones were taken from the grave and sanctified by an irregular and posthumous sacrament. In the 9th, 10th, and 11th centuries of the Christian era, the reign of the Gospel and of the Church was extended over Bulgaria, Hungary, Bohemia, Saxony, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Poland, and Russia. The triumphs of apostolic zeal were repeated in the Iron Age of Christianity, and the northern and eastern regions of Europe submitted to a religion more different in theory than in practice from the worship of their native idols. A laudable ambition excited the monks, both of Germany and Greece, to visit the tents and huts of the barbarians. Poverty, hardships, and dangers were the lot of the first missionaries. Their courage was active and patient, their motive pure and meritorious. Their present reward consisted in the testimony of their conscience and the respect of a grateful people. But the fruitful harvest of their toils was inherited and enjoyed by the proud and wealthy prelates of succeeding times. The first conversions were free and spontaneous. A holy life and an eloquent tongue were the only arms of the missionaries. But the domestic fables of the pagans were silenced by the miracles and visions of the strangers, and the favorable temper of the chiefs was accelerated by the dictates of vanity and interest. The leaders of nations, who were saluted with the titles of kings and saints, held it lawful and pious to impose the Catholic faith on their subjects and neighbors. The coast of the Baltic, from Holstein to the Gulf of Finland, was invaded under the standard of the cross, and the reign of idolatry was closed by the conversion of Lithuania in the 14th century. Yet truth and candor must acknowledge that the conversion of the north imparted many temporal benefits both to the old and the new Christians. The rage of war, inherent to the human species, could not be healed by the evangelic precepts of charity and peace, and the ambition of Catholic princes has renewed in every age the calamities of hostile contention. But the admission of the barbarians into the pale of civil and ecclesiastical society delivered Europe from the depredations, by sea and land, of the Normans, the Hungarians, and the Russians, who learned to spare their brethren and cultivate their possessions. The establishment of law and order was promoted by the influence of the clergy, and the rudiments of art and science were introduced into the savage countries of the globe. The liberal piety of the Russian princes engaged in their service the most skillful of the Greeks to decorate the cities and instruct the inhabitants. The dome and the paintings of Santa Sophia were rudely copied in the churches of Kiev and Novgorod. The writings of the fathers were translated into the Slavonic idiom, and 300 noble youths were invited, or compelled, to attend the lessons of the College of Yaroslavs. It should appear that Russia might have derived an early and rapid improvement from her peculiar connection with the church and state of Constantinople, which at that age so justly despised the ignorance of the Latins. But the Byzantine nation was servile, solitary, and verging to a hasty decline. After the fall of Kiev, the navigation of the Borysthenes was forgotten. The great princes of Volodymyr and Moscow were separated from the sea and Christendom, and the divided monarchy was oppressed by the ignominy and blindness of Tatar servitude. The Slavonic and Scandinavian kingdoms, which had been converted by the Latin missionaries, were exposed, it is true, to the spiritual jurisdiction and temporal claims of the popes. But they were united in language and religious worship with each other, and with Rome. They imbibed the free and generous spirit of the European Republic, and gradually shared the light of knowledge which arose on the Western world. Chapter 56. The Saracens, Franks, and Greeks in Italy. First Adventures and Settlement of the Normans. Character and Conquest of Robert Guiscard, Duke of Apulia. Deliverance of Sicily by his brother Roger. Victories of Robert over the emperors of the East and West. Roger, King of Sicily, invades Africa and Greece. The Emperor Manuel Comnenus. Wars of the Greeks and Normans. Extinction of the Normans. The three great nations of the world, the Greeks, the Saracens, and the Franks, encountered each other on the theater of Italy. The southern provinces, which now composed the Kingdom of Naples, were subject, for the most part, to the Lombard dukes and princes of Beneventum, so powerful in war that they checked for a moment the genius of Charlemagne, so liberal in peace that they maintained in their capital an academy of 32 philosophers and grammarians. The division of the flourishing state produced the rival principalities of Benevento, Salerno, and Capua, and the thoughtless ambition or revenge of the competitors invited the Saracens to the ruin of their common inheritance. During a calamitous period of 200 years, Italy was exposed to a repetition of wounds which the invaders were not capable of healing by the union and tranquility of a perfect conquest. Their frequent and almost annual squadrons issued from the port of Palermo and were entertained with too much indulgence by the Christians of Naples. The more formidable fleets were prepared on the African coast, and even the Arabs of Andalusia were sometimes tempted to assist or oppose the Muslims of an adverse sect. In the revolution of human events, a new ambuscade was concealed in the Caudine Forks. The fields of Cannae were bedewed a second time with the blood of the Africans, and the sovereign of Rome again attacked or defended the walls of Capua and Tarentum. A colony of Saracens had been planted at Bari, which commands the entrance of the Adriatic Gulf, and their impartial depredations provoked the resentment and conciliated the union of the two emperors. An offensive alliance was concluded between Basil the Macedonian, the first of his race, and Louis, the great-grandson of Charlemagne, and each party supplied the deficiencies of his associate. It would have been imprudent in the Byzantine monarch to transport his stationary troops of Asia to an Italian campaign, and the Latin arms would have been insufficient if his superior navy had not occupied the mouth of the Gulf. The fortress of Bari was invested by the infantry of the Franks, and by the cavalry and galleys of the Greeks. And after a defense of 4 years, the Arabian emir submitted to the clemency of Louis, who commanded in person the operations of the siege. This important conquest had been achieved by the concord of the East and West, but their recent amity was soon embittered by the mutual complaints of jealousy and pride. The Greeks assumed as their own the merit of the conquest and the pomp of the triumph, extolled the greatness of their powers, and affected to deride the intemperance and sloth of the handful of barbarians who appeared under the banners of the Carlovingian prince. His reply is expressed with the eloquence of indignation and truth. "We confess the magnitude of your preparation," says the great-grandson of Charlemagne. "Your armies were indeed as numerous as a cloud of summer locusts, who darken the day, flap their wings, and after a short flight tumble weary and breathless to the ground. Like them, ye sunk after a feeble effort. Ye were vanquished by your own cowardice, and withdrew from the scene of action to injure and despoil our Christian subjects of the Sclavonian coast. We were few in number, and why were we few? Because after a tedious expectation of your arrival, I had dismissed my host, and retained only a chosen band of warriors to continue the blockade of the city. If they indulged their hospitable feasts in the face of danger and death, did these feasts abate the vigor of their enterprise? Is it by your fasting that the walls of Bari have been overturned? Did not these valiant Franks, diminished as they were by languor and fatigue, intercept and vanish the three most powerful emirs of the Saracens? And did not their defeat precipitate the fall of the city? Bari is now fallen. Tarentum trembles. Calabria will be delivered. And if we command the sea, the island of Sicily may be rescued from the hands of the infidels. My brother," a name most offensive to the vanity of the Greek, "accelerate your naval succors, respect your allies, and distrust your flatterers." These lofty hopes were soon extinguished by the death of Louis and the decay of the Carlovingian house. And whoever might deserve the honor, the Greek emperors Basil and his son Leo secured the advantage of the reduction of Bari. The Italians of Apulia and Calabria were persuaded or compelled to acknowledge their supremacy, and an ideal line from Mount Garganus to the Bay of Salerno leaves the far greater part of the kingdom of Naples under the dominion of the Eastern Empire. Beyond that line, the dukes or republics of Amalfi and Naples, who had never forfeited their voluntary allegiance, rejoiced in the neighborhood of their lawful sovereign, and Amalfi was enriched by supplying Europe with the produce and manufactures of Asia. But the Lombard princes of Benevento, Salerno, and Capua were reluctantly torn from the communion of the Latin world, and too often violated their oaths of servitude and tribute. The city of Bari rose to dignity and wealth as the metropolis of the new theme or province of Lombardy.